This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. CASA is a nonprofit that trains volunteers for the local court system to speak for children who have suffered abuse and neglect. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. And here in Southeast Tennessee, CASA of Bradley and Polk Counties, based in Cleveland, marks 10 years of service on August 18th. Christopher Genetsko is the executive director of CASA, and Natalie Barrio Nuevo manages the volunteers.
Christopher, Natalie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us more about CASA.
So CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and what we do is we work with community volunteers to advocate for children that are involved in our court system due to primarily abuse and neglect situations. So we train those volunteers, we put them through a nationally approved 30-hour training curriculum. They learned how to look out for what the needs are of a child that's been abused and neglected. Once they complete that training process, they're sworn in by a judge and able to advocate as a court officer. So once they're sworn in, they go into the child's home, they see where the child lives, they talk to the child, get to know them on a personal level. They're going to likely talk to that child's teachers and any other interested parties. Once they feel like they have a good understanding of what's in that child's best interest, they will make a recommendation to the judge. And the cool thing is that locally and nationally, the judge will implement the recommendation, the advocate, about 90% of the time. So we really are a trusted resource for our communities.
And this is a national organization. Tell us more about the presence of CASA here in Tennessee, and in particular, in our part of Tennessee.
CASA is part of a national association, though each organization is a separate 501c nonprofit. So our local office covers Bradley and Polk counties, but you know, our surrounding counties around Chattanooga area and in North Georgia are covered by separate CASA offices. So if people find interest in volunteering with those, I encourage them to look in their own county before they reach out to us, though we will be more than willing to have them. But we definitely see CASAs all across the country and within our state, especially here in Eastern Tennessee. It just seems like we have a really strong presence.
And you have a really strong presence in rural areas. Natalie, talk to me more about that.
In our rural areas, we have a really good presence because we don't have many services in those counties. Whereas like in Bradley County itself, we have counseling set up, we have drug testing centers, we have all of those things that can come in and work with the children and get the children into programs needed. But in our rural communities, that's not there. They have school and home, and that's pretty much the basis. So for CASA in those communities, we're not only the eyes and ears to the judge, we're also a resource for those families to connect them to things that they may be needing that they don't even know exist that are in Bradley County that maybe they can get to.
What trends were you seeing there in Bradley and Polk counties before the coronavirus pandemic hit?
So before the coronavirus pandemic hit, most of the stuff we were seeing previous to this was just our basic dependency and neglect cases that we deal with on every day, such as drug use and those type of concerns, or just the neglectful lifestyle. So that's what we were seeing previous to Corona.
A lot of it is during, you know, surrounding situation of opioids. Would you agree with that, Natalie?
Yes, most of my cases almost all of them involve opioids.
As far as now, what are we seeing? What are we hearing?
Now we're getting into the homelessness more. I've lost my job. I need assistance with someone to help care for my kids because I don't have a job. I'm losing my housing. So there's a lot of that economic impact that has kind of hit with coronavirus, with families not able to care for the kids due to financial situations.
And how much has this increased your workload?
It's increased quite a bit. Our workload has increased from two perspectives. One being that the financial crisis has increased it, but also because when courts were closed, now we're having all of that where no one could even access the courts to get children into a safe position. And so once it opened, then we fell into everyone trying to get into the courtroom.
What challenges have you faced in training and maintaining volunteers during this time with COVID-19?
So we've switched our trainings to being primary online using National CASA's online classroom. And then they do several of those hours in online training, Zoom meetings with Natalie. But there's a combination of work in a traditional like online classroom setting and then the Zoom meetings. So it's the same content, but it's all done online now. But the recruitment definitely has been slowing down. I definitely see my advertising dollars are not going as far as it used to. And we're really at a point where we can't slow down our work because we need to make sure that we have eyes and ears looking out for these children, especially when a lot of them are spending even more and more time at home. And it's typically teachers and childcare professionals that are making those recommendations to the hotline that there needs to be somebody looking out for these children's best interests. So it's definitely not a time to slow down. And we really are hoping just to continue to add to our volunteer advocate program. We currently have 25 regularly serving volunteer advocates, and we'd ideally would like to have about 35. So we could definitely use some more.
And tell us more about what it takes to train a volunteer.
They get 30 hours of training, and that includes a lot of, well, with the online portion, they're getting a lot of coursework in what does child abuse look like? What is minimum sufficient level of care and how do we handle that? What is acceptable for a child to be in versus is not in? We also train them on how to not only look for those things, but how to work with these families. Because in the state of Tennessee, reunification is the primary goal. That's the goal that we begin with, is trying to reunify these kids with their families if it's safe, stable, and possible. And so we train them on how to work with these families and how to locate the resources that they're needing and how to help them to implement it through the courts. The training that we go over, it is how to identify abuse and neglect, how level of care, what that is, and what that looks like in our communities for our children. We also teach them how to make recommendations to our court, hair follicle drug screens, mental health assessments. Housing and job stability are some of those recommendations, counseling for our children, counseling for the families. We also teach them how to work with our families because it's not just when you're making a child safe in a safe environment. The goal in Tennessee is to reunify if it's a safe and stable environment or if we can make it that way. With that, we try to work with our families to make it safe and stable. So we teach our advocates how to work with those families while maintaining safety for the child.
And where can people go online for more information? Where can they call?
They can go visit our website at casabp.org. The BP stands for Bradley Polk, so that's casabp.org. And they can also give us a call at 423-472-5800. Once again, that's 423-472-5800.
All right, Christopher, Natalie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Here in Chattanooga, the Rossville Boulevard Action and Planning Group seeks to build a thriving community for its residents and businesses, celebrating its diverse culture. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Heather Herwire, the group's director, and Jasmine LeBlanc, director of the Ella Library.
Heather, Jasmine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Tell us more about your group and what it does.
Jasmine and I have both lived in the Eastlake neighborhood, which borders the Rossville Boulevard corridor. We've been neighborhood residents for several years, and we connected in the winter of 2017 just over a shared interest that the Rossville Boulevard corridor has a lot of potential, but we weren't hearing people in the greater Chattanooga community talk about the potential or look at improving the corridor. We launched a community survey in the spring of 2018, which got a lot of feedback and interest. We found other people were feeling the same way. They wanted to see the community improved. They felt that the city should focus their efforts on that. From that survey, we received a grant from the Lindhurst Foundation to do an initial community visioning and kind of a very high-level planning project. We've kind of just continued doing some neighborhood tactical projects and also working on some planning. The RPA did a planning project for the Rossville Boulevard corridor back in 2004. And one thing we're doing is kind of trying to pick up where that project left off, recognizing that the RPA wasn't equipped to execute some of the items in that project. And we're hoping to execute some of those things that were listed there.
Well, also because a lot of the things we heard back from our community members were pretty much the same as the RPA's plan. So we had a good starting point between the interviews that we had been doing, the research we had been doing, and what had already been written down still needed to be executed. So we went ahead and we're trying to implement some of those projects.
Our focus is on Rossville Boulevard from the Tennessee-Georgia state line up to where the interstate crosses over Rossville Boulevard. So it's a 2.2-mile stretch.
And for folks who don't get out there much, tell us what we see there now.
Don't see a whole lot. One of the reasons we just feel like the community is a lot of the buildings look kind of run down. There's not a lot of unity, I think, in how maybe people maintain their property or different types of commercial signs. There's a lot of diversity in the signs. You might see a lot of buildings that are either boarded up, have interesting decor and facade. One of the best things that's happened to our community over the past few years is the influx of Hispanic businesses. So we have maybe 7 Latino tiendas along the boulevard and a few Hispanic restaurants as well. So we've seen those businesses come and they'll buy banks that had been shut down or just old stores that had been shut down, renovate them, and they're working businesses now.
And then tell us about bench building.
Yeah, bench building. We, as we drove around our community, one thing that we're kind of always thinking and wondering about is just placemaking and how Roswell Boulevard might feel like a more inviting and friendly space to be. There's no kind of public seating places. We don't have very many CARTA sanctioned bus stops in our community either, but the bus runs, you know, up and down Roswell Boulevard and through Dodds Avenue every day. So we felt like making benches out of pallets would be an easy way to start, kind of cast the reel and see if there was any interest. So we, over the past 2 years, have built 2 pallet benches ourselves and put them out at different bus stops in the community. And it's exciting to see how well received and utilized they are, whether that be by people riding the city bus or even by students waiting for the school buses. And we had received a second round of funding from the Lyndhurst Foundation and thought it could be fun to see if anybody from the community had creative ideas of what they think benches might look like. So we hosted a competition. However, we recognize that people have had a lot going on with the pandemic and we didn't receive any submissions before our competition officially ended, but we had one neighbor submit a late submission and then she's also actually coordinating with several other neighbors to complete the remaining benches. So we're excited to put those out, some at a bus stop, a soccer field, hopefully partner with Metropolitan Ministries, which is relocating to the Boulevard. They have a bus stop in front of their building, and so we'll plan to put a bench out there to help with their guests.
And then moving forward, what's next?
Yeah, we have a lot of things that we're working on. We've been coordinating with CDOT. One of the projects that we mentioned we wanted to pick up on was electrical work installed along the south end of the boulevard to try and have pedestrian lights, again, to just make the community feel more welcoming and also safer to have lighting in the evening. So we've been working with CDOT to see how we could get those pedestrian lamps installed. Also trying to do some improvements with striping some bike lanes in our community. We recognize that sidewalks are expensive, but by striping a bike lane, we can create a safe place for pedestrians to walk in highly areas. Roswell Boulevard does get a lot of foot traffic, but it also gets a lot of actual traffic, and cars and semi-trucks drive down the boulevard at close to 50 miles an hour. Traffic lights are only half a mile apart. So one concept we've been working with CDOT on is installing a pedestrian refuge so that residents could walk halfway across the street, have a safe place in the median to wait, and then continue to cross over. So we are hopeful that a pedestrian refuge will be installed around the 34th Street intersection later this summer, or hopefully before the end of the calendar year.
And if people want more information about all that you do, where can they go online? Where can they call?
Well, right now, the majority of our work is posted on Facebook. We're working on building out a webpage that has more details since we have a lot of content now. We're also about to put out a couple open calls for local muralists, primarily, hopefully, if they're in the Eastlake Roswell area, but in the general Chattanooga area would also be great. We just want to be able to highlight the community, bring a little bit more color, and tell some stories that way. And those are going to go out through our Facebook. So Roswell BLVD is where you can find the project and all the information there. And then when you're there, you can actually get signed up for our newsletter, which goes out pretty regularly with updates on what's going on. Not overly regularly, but at least once a month so people can stay connected. And through that, we've managed to build up an advisory group of people who are committed and involved, which has been great in helping keep direction and keep momentum going on the projects that we're working on. The other project that we have going right now is we have a call for stories about the Roswell Boulevard area, trying to pick up where some community storytelling ended in 1986 about the Eastlake Trinity, which had some great moments mentioned from history to that point, but there has been nothing really documenting the community since then. And we know that that was a more trying time for the Chattanooga community as a whole, But we know that even during that time, there were moments that people should remember and celebrate, and we want to be able to capture those memories as they relate to Eastlake, Clifton Hills, and Rossell Boulevard.
All right. Heather, Jasmine, thanks so much.
No, thank you.
Here on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, Professor Jill Shelton teaches a class on the psychology of aging. Last summer, her students volunteered to work in facilities for aging residents. That's not possible now due to the coronavirus, so for the class project this summer, her students created activity kits with games and puzzles to spur cognitive stimulation, delivering the kits to Summit View Senior Community at the base of Signal Mountain.
Jill, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the psychology of aging class project that took place this summer, given the unique conditions still very much with us.
The psychology of aging class at UTC has recently been designated an experiential learning course. And typically, students would be in aging facilities or elsewhere in the community doing service projects to support elders. Of course, that was not possible this summer. Rather than just canceling the project, I felt like it was important for our students to have some hands-on experience to support elders who are particularly impacted by the current pandemic. And so, as everyone knows, people living in residential communities or long-term care facilities are being put in isolation. They're not allowed to have visitors. So what we wanted to do is find a way to help these elders stay engaged. We know that social isolation leads to cognitive dysfunction, and so we wanted to find a way to create activities that would be cognitively stimulating. So the students, I had 28 students in the class, and they worked in groups to develop materials to put in these activity kits so that elders could feel like they were engaging in activities that kept their minds active. We had them reflecting on their life and things that they were proud of. And so the students were really creative in coming up with ideas about ways that we could engage people living in the Summit View facility.
And in these types of goodie bags, we're talking about what?
For example, we had activity booklets that would include crossword puzzles that students came up with. So it might have a 4th of July theme, something about summer. They went into even into the holidays coming up with crossword puzzles or other types of like Sudoku puzzles. They had coloring activities, so things that helped people make associations. So anything that they could do to help elders keep their mind active. We also had some groups that put in journals, and they would have prompts to help elders think about aspects of their life, things that made them happy, things about their family that they could reflect on. So we're helping them prompt memory, but also trying to create a positive climate for elders doing these activities. We had cards in the activity kit so people could do card games. What was really great about the students, not only were they very thoughtful in the activities that they come up with, but they also recruited help from local businesses to help make donations. So for example, we have Solutions Pharmacy, a local business in Chattanooga that donated hand sanitizer, lotion, and some self-care products. So it was really great to see students interacting with local businesses in a way to give back to elders in the community.
And typically these students would be at that facility volunteering, but of course this summer that's something they couldn't do.
Absolutely. And it was really fascinating to read the students' reflection paper. So they wrote about this experience throughout the process, the planning, the ideas that they had, trying to put themselves in the situation of someone living in a long-term care facility and being in isolation. And they reflected afterwards about the experience, and they were overwhelmingly positive about what it meant to them to be able to do something nice for people in the community. But consistently, I saw students saying the only regret they had is that they could not be in the facility with these elders. And so I'm hoping that when we get to a time where that's possible, some of these students will be inspired to actually go into those facilities, visit and learn from older adults.
And tell us more about the response that you received from those older adults about this project.
The residents of this aging facility, Summit View, were really excited and felt touched to have students be thinking about them and coming up with activities to keep them engaged. And elders are known for really wanting to give back to the next generation. And so to have that generation provide the time and energy to come up with these packages was just really a touching experience for them. But like the students, the residents most want to have interaction with other people. And so I think as a community, we need to continue thinking about ways that we can reach out to people who are isolated and find ways to engage with them socially and let them know that we're thinking about them.
All right, Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. The Songbirds Guitar Museum and the two performance spaces affiliated with the museum on the campus of the Chattanooga Choo Choo is closing permanently on Saturday, August 15th. Our guest Brian Shannon, host and producer of the Songbirds podcast, which airs on WUTC on Friday afternoons at 2 o'clock, has worked at the museum first as a guide and more recently as their membership coordinator. Was that a shock to you?
Yeah, indeed it was. I had no idea. The writing, I guess, around us was on the wall once we initially closed earlier this year, once the first sort of wave of the shutdown happened for us. And then, you know, we closed recently for an additional 2 weeks once the mask mandate was put into place for Hamilton County. But, you know, we were still really moving ahead. We have, you know, shows on the books to do. We have a special event coming up on Friday with a contest winner who's traveling down to do a player experience with us, a young 18-year-old fantastic guitar player. And did not expect that. We got called in for a meeting yesterday afternoon, and Johnny Smith, our president, communicated with us the very, very tough news and the decision to close the doors on the 15th.
Mm-hmm. And it's just because you couldn't bring people in through the door and so couldn't sustain the museum? Is that what it comes down to? It's as simple as that?
Yeah, it's a financial decision. Our lease here at the Choo Choo is coming up at the end of in October, and in the face of really, you know, the declining numbers, it was not steady. It has been just an absolutely sharp, precipitous drop of attendees. Not only in the museum, just coming in to visit. This is normally our busiest, or has been for the last 3 years, the busiest time of year for us, just before school is starting back. But with the live shows, which was obviously a big part of what we were doing here with both of the stages. We were cut down now. You know, at our peak, we were running four to five shows, four to five nights a week, upstairs and downstairs at the north and south stages. And we've only been doing shows at the south stage at 50% maximum capacity since we've reopened. And we just have not had the attendance and the numbers here to be able to keep the doors open to sustain the business.
People are nervous about that. So you started out as a museum.
Right, we did. Whenever we first opened the doors, you know, really the main goal of opening this up here was to show off these fantastic instruments, this great guitar collection. And from there, it evolved. You know, we were run and led by people who were professional musicians and saw, you know, in with our space and what we had here, you know, this opportunity to be able to host live, great live music, and really put together for what I thought, you know. And I started here with the museum as a member before, as a customer before, you know, joining and working here. Saw what we were doing, especially with the upstairs, the north stage, was something very unique with being able to put on live performances, you know, in the midst of the heart of the collection itself, and have these great world-class performers come in surrounded by an incredible collection of instruments to play right in the middle of them. It was, you know, really, really special.
It did. It made a lot of sense. What you were celebrating with the museum became something immediate and real when you can bring musicians in to play in that space. And I'm sure they felt the same way, being surrounded by history like that.
It was, I remembering Sarah Watkins playing here very early on, and it was a, you know, really, the goal initially with the upstairs space was to create a listening room, think of like an Eddie's attic in Decatur, or, you know, these, you know, quieter type rooms. And she was playing a solo acoustic show, and I remember she had started a song and she hit a wrong note, and she stopped, you know, at the beginning, smiled and said into her mic, she said, I guess my guitar is just a little intimidated. And then proceeded to play an amazing song. And you could watch artists. I watched Tommy Emmanuel on stage play here, one of our shows, you know, one of the first shows that we had here. And you could watch the artist's eyes, and you would see them looking at a case of incredible Rickenbacker guitars. So it created a very unique experience, not just for the people listening, but for the artists playing here. And, you know, as you know, with live performance, it's a feedback loop, right? You've got energy that the artist gives to the people that are listening, and then it comes back to the artist, and it gets fed back in music, and just it was really, really special.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that always interested me about that space was that it wasn't designed as a listening room, and yet it had great acoustics, didn't it?
It did. We were very fortunate. Part of that was, I think, a happy accident. I mean, we have these Carnegie steel columns that run throughout the entire terminal station here at the Choo Choo. So you've got some really hard acoustic qualities that you think should make for a poor listening experience. But something magic about the room worked. And I know one of the other things too, part of the design, the back bounce for the stage was reclaimed burned barn wood that had been reclaimed from a barn in Northwest Georgia. And it still had the ash. Like if I walked out right now and ran my hand down it, like the ash would actually come off on your fingertips. And I think that actually worked as a bit of a damper. So there was some, you know, definite intended design to help there, but there was, I think it was also just kind of a, something we looked into here with the room as well.
Brian Shannon is our guest. In addition to being the membership coordinator at the Songbirds Guitar Museum, he also hosts the Songbirds podcast. The museum and the two affiliated performance spaces are set to close on August 15th, victims of the pandemic. But while the pandemic derailed the museum, it gave Brian access to artists who might otherwise not have had time to talk to him for the podcast.
One of the benefits, if you will, of a lot of these great touring national artists not being able to tour right now, if you want to look at a silver lining, is our accessibility to them. So one of the things that we've worked on here in developing is our podcast. And just in recent, really in the last 2 months, we've had some of the best guests for that experience that we've had in the history of our show. We had Brian Ray, an internationally known guitarist who's played with Etta James, Smokey Robinson, and Sir Paul McCartney as a guest recently. G.E. Smith played with Dylan, you know, Saturday Night Live band leader for years. We've had some really top tier people available to help out. I'm hoping we can continue doing that in some capacity. The brand is not going away. The foundation, of course, is still, you know, in operation as well, too. So we will see. Right now, we've really just got our eyes on the 15th of August as being the date that we're going to close. But, you know, there's certainly some time in between now and then to sort of sort out things and see what will happen next.
When they hired you, as you said, you began as a member, as a fan. When they hired you, how did they describe the job that they wanted you to do?
Yeah. Well, my first role was just as leading tours. That was I had a completely separate full-time job that allowed me to be back. I traveled during the week, would be home during the weekend. So my first role was just, hey, you are excited about these instruments and seem to know a thing or two about them. Can you come in and talk with people about them on Saturdays and on the weekends? So that was where it started initially. But whenever the opportunity presented itself to come on full-time, it was really to I think, fill in some gaps for some things that I saw as opportunities to grow here. One of them was membership. You know, we have this great community of not only musicians, but also of people who appreciate and love music and history here in Chattanooga, and it was to try to help grow the membership program. So that was one of the things that was my charge. And then, you know, we were looking to try to, you know, do some things in the future in the way of these sort of rock and roll fantasy camps where people will go and get to play with an artist. We were, had it in the works. We were trying to organize one where people would not only have an opportunity to play with a top tier, top level talent, but to get to play with them on pieces from our collection, which would have been completely unique. So we have been working for a few months on trying to make that happen in a COVID world. And then the branding through our social, through our podcast and through our outreach, in media that way.
Well, it's a beautiful collection, but they are instruments. They are designed to be played, right? My guess would be that they're better instruments if they're played, as opposed to just sort of keeping them in a showcase. Is that true?
Absolutely. There's literally a chemical reaction that happens with the body chemistry as it plays the fretboard on an instrument. It's made, these are made of wood for the most part, and are made to organically interact with people. So they're absolutely made to be played, to have their hands on them, to be even down to the neck. And on a Gibson guitar, if you don't keep the proper tension with strings on it, it causes basically the guitar to warp. So they're made to be ready to play and played for sure.
So you have this wonderful collection of string instruments, musicians who want to come and play, and people who'd like to play with those musicians. What you don't have is a place to present them. Mm-hmm. What do you think is coming in the future? Have you any sense of that? Do you think that this is an idea whose time has passed, or is it just a hiatus for you guys?
I think for what was here, I don't think we'll see that again as they were presented here in this volume. I don't know the future. I know the immediate plans. There are two sort of families of instruments here at our collection. We have the ones that are part of Songbirds LLC. Those are ones we call those black card guitars here. Those are cards. If you come to the museum and you see the description cards, they have a black background. Those will all go back into storage, and then will be managed by the curator and the people who manage the collection offsite. The other guitars that are here are actually owned by the foundation, which is not going anywhere. The Songbirds Foundation, which does great work with the Music in Our Schools program, putting guitars in the hands of kids and giving lessons and things like that. The foundation guitars will go back into storage for the foundation, and they'll use those guitars at events, really as the foundation sees fit to still be able to work with. So those will kind of go to a separate place. As far as the future goes, I would have to think that there somewhere down the road will be, in a more limited way, an opportunity to display these in a way that others can enjoy them. We've had already today several calls about pieces from the collection, some people who are pretty well-known collectors in the country who've reached out to kind of see what's going to happen next. We have some celebrity instruments. We still have a guitar on display, one of B.B. King's original Lucille's that's on display up at the Ryman still. So my hope is that, and I think, in trusting the people who are behind this, that they will still have a life after what's happening here, and they'll end here on the 15th of August here at Station Street.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Not only are they... they have both a sort of practical role, if you will. They're string instruments that you can play, but at the same time, they're works of art.
They are. I remember there was a musician I was talking with sometime last year, and he made a comment, people really react to vintage instruments in a couple of different ways. On the one hand, you have people who I think fall more in line with you and I, where these are great works of art, these are precious pieces of history, and there are other musicians who really don't necessarily share the same appreciation. They you know, respect the instruments, but they're more about, they see them more as directly as tools to perform with. And then, of course, people kind of fall all along the way of the spectrum there. But anyway, it's, the musician I was talking to said, he was tongue-in-cheek, but said, a guitar museum, isn't that like going to an art museum that's just paintbrushes? And that comment, that haunted me, that stayed with me for a few days, because this has been my life. This is something that I've been very passionate about for years, and been here at the museum. And it was actually my wife, we were talking, you know, days after the fact, and I shared with her, you know, what this artist had said and how it really kind of bothered me. And she said, oh, I don't see it that way at all. She goes, if anything, I see the guitar museum as more like, it would be like a NASCAR museum with cars. You have the cars and the machines that get people where they're going, but then you have the drivers, and that'd be the players, right? And she just said that very briefly, and suddenly all was right with the world again, and the paradigm lined up. And I was like, okay, I can, that makes sense. I can live with that. So
I'm sorry that everything has been brought to such an abrupt halt. I wish you well.
Well, thank you for talking with me and letting us kind of share about this, and thanks for what you're doing, and all the work that you do to help promote, you know, music here in the city. And I hope you will continue doing that. We can hopefully have something else to talk about again, more positive in the future.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it was good to talk to you, Brian. And please,
thanks, Richard.
Stay in touch. Shannon was the membership coordinator for the Songbirds Guitar Museum, which is set to close on August 15th. But Brian will continue to host the Songbirds podcast, which is also here on WUTC on Friday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Brian also conceived the Ultimate Player Experience, a contest offering the winner the opportunity to play some of the guitars in the collection alongside this man, Joe Bonamassa.
Stress. Why don't we go out tonight? Put on your favorite dress. Let's drive.
18-year-old Jeff Cruzan will be playing with Joe Bonamassa at the Songbirds Museum tomorrow morning. Later in the afternoon, he will record a song in a professional recording studio and will cap the day playing alongside Paul Childers in a tribute to Stevie Ray Vaughan in Songbirds South tomorrow night. For Scenic Roots, I'm Richard Winham.
The Chattanooga Symphony and Opera had to pause when the coronavirus hit back in March. Recently, the CSO announced plans to resume playing, though not as originally scheduled. Samantha Teeter is the CSO's executive director. Samantha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about how the Symphony and Opera is moving forward at this time.
Sure. So I think the last time we talked, obviously, we had shut down at the end of our 2019-20 season in mid-March. And typically the summer is when our musicians are on break anyway. So we actually started having conversations in April with our union to begin talking about what could possibly happen in our 2021 season. And I think early on, all of us knew, you know, we needed to do something. We needed to continue to serve our community. You know, it was important to us to continue to employ our musicians, as so many of them are struggling with just being furloughed and laid off, and so many of their other non-symphony gigs being canceled. So we had some really great talks, and just a few weeks ago, we were able to come to a plan. So what we're looking at is employing our contract musicians for 66% of their normal guaranteed services. So that could be, let's just say, you know, one of our contract levels gets 90 services every season. Now they're going to get 60. Not a perfect world scenario, but still able to keep those musicians employed for part of the season. We are looking at doing smaller chamber works, so no more than 20 musicians on stage at a time, no full orchestra concerts, unfortunately. Keeping our musicians socially distanced from each other, keeping them socially distanced from the audience, and as well as having smaller audience capacities. And again, making sure those people are socially distanced, wearing a mask. So we're looking at starting right after Labor Day. We'll have more information coming out probably within the next week as far as what those concerts will look like. So we're excited to have a plan and just hope we can continue with it as long as things don't get worse in the pandemic.
And as far as the financial support that you would need to proceed in this way, where's that coming from?
We really hope that our donors are continue to step up and support us. Our budget for this fiscal year is actually 50% of what it normally is. Most of that is from loss of earned revenue. Several of our subscribers who have already subscribed to a regular season know that it won't be normal. Some have requested refunds, which of course is absolutely something that we will do. But what we're looking to do is offer subscribers the chance to come to these live performances for no additional cost. Their subscription will cover it. We're also going to be live streaming and recording several of the concerts that they will have free access to. But by having now content on our website, we'll also be able to offer that to anyone who wants to, say, pay $10 or $15, you know, to watch a CSO concert. So with that loss of earned revenue, our contributed revenue is important more than ever. So our donors, we really are going to ask to continue to support us. We are still, you know, a funded partner of Arts Build, the Tennessee Arts Commission. We still have some corporate sponsors who are very supportive of us and are continuing to help provide us with revenue as well.
How does what you are doing compare with similar organizations here in the Southeast or elsewhere in the country?
You know, we heard the news probably, you know, starting in early July, late June, that several orchestras were just shutting down. Nashville Symphony announced that they were shutting down for their 2021 season. Some other orchestras that I've worked with or that I hear about are doing the same thing. But then you do hear about orchestras like the Richmond Symphony, Colorado Symphony, those who are trying to move forward with similar kind of capacities that we're looking at as far as smaller orchestras, smaller concerts. So it really runs the gamut. I mean, those that are just completely shutting down and furloughing everybody to those like us who are really trying to make something work.
And in trying to make something work, how's your morale? How's the morale of your colleagues? How's the morale of these musicians that are being brought back into the fold, albeit on a reduced basis?
One of the things about Chattanooga Symphony and Opera, you know, this is the third orchestra I've worked with. I will say the relationship between management and board with the musicians has always been a pretty positive one. Me as executive director, it's important to me to be transparent and to work with musicians and just making sure that we're all in this together. So I feel like the talks went very well. I feel like we worked together to really come up with this plan. It wasn't just CSO management telling musicians what they were going to do. It was a joint conversation. And so, you know, I believe many of the musicians are thankful that they have a job to return to, albeit not at the same level as they typically would. Our staff, you know, most of them continue to work from home. We will be open to the public starting next week for shortened hours, but our staff has you know, it's been a challenge. But I think, again, having a plan has been, I think, the best thing to really kind of increase the morale. You know, the unknown is what's just been so challenging for so many of us for the past several months. So I feel like now that we all have a plan and it's something we can move forward with, I feel like we're all ready to go.
And where can people go online for more information? Keep up to date.
Yeah, hopefully once we get these concerts scheduled, we will have those on our website at chattanoogasymphony.org. Some of them we are anticipating will be free to the public. Like I said, several of them will be live streamed or recorded on our website that people will be able to access. So hopefully by next week, we should have more information available.
All right. Samantha, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ray.
The Tennessee Valley Railroad Museum here in Chattanooga is rolling ahead while navigating safety during life under COVID-19. Steve Freer is operations supervisor at the museum.
Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ray. Glad to be here.
Tell us how you are running things now at the museum. Well, things are definitely different as they are everywhere. We were closed for a while. We were closed for almost 2 months, but we have reopened. In June, we reopened the Tennessee Valley Railroad Museum for Missionary Ridge Local Service. That is our standard ride, and we are running that currently 4 days a week, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. So you might call it an extended weekend. And we are running four departures on each of those days. They're running at 9:30, 11:30, 1:30, and 3:30. So we have four trains a day, and they have been well received. We do have pretty good ridership. Obviously, we're at a much smaller capacity than normal, and following all of the guidelines that have been put forth, a lot of things are going on as far as trying to keep everyone safe, not only the riders, but also our staff as well. But we are planning on adding some of the other train rides back into the schedule. There are some decisions that still have to be made and some planning, but we do hope that some of the trips into Northwest Georgia, such as the Chickamauga Turn, will be able to restart. We are planning on running our dinner trains with some restrictions, probably starting in August. Our satellite service out of Etowah, Tennessee, the Hiawassee River Rail Adventure Trips, we are hoping to reopen that again on a limited basis, probably with our standard loop trip, which goes to Farner rather than all the way to Copper Hill, just so that it's a shorter trip. And then looking forward to autumn and even into Christmas. We do have our popular North Pole Limited service that has run for over 20 years, and we're looking at that, seeing there's any changes that need to be made and trying to decide on dates and times and things like that. But we're hopeful that we'll be able to have somewhat of a season this year. It's definitely been challenging.
What are the challenges that you've had so far? The idea of riding a train, even if you make room for social distancing on the train, it's a different experience.
Well, it is. In some ways, it's somewhat enjoyable because you have a little bit more elbow room, you might say. But again, we're following all the guidelines. We have touchless ticketing currently. We're encouraging people to buy their tickets for the Missionary Ridge Local in advance. And that way, when they arrive on property, again, following the protocol right now, masks are required not only on the train, but also in the stations and with the county guidelines that we're following as well. You know, anytime a visitor is around anyone else within 6 feet, then they should be wearing a mask. So I guess you could say that for a majority of the visit, people will be wearing masks. But of course, we're encouraging social distancing. We have that reduction in capacity. Our walkways have been set up for single direction. We have increased cleaning and sanitizing protocols that are being followed, especially on the train in between our departure times. Not only do we have a lower capacity on the Missionary Ridge Local trains, but we also have a longer in between the departure times, so less frequent departures, so that we do have time for that cleaning in between the train times. We have installed touchless restroom fixtures and I think nearly 24 hand sanitizing stations throughout the property. Again, we're encouraging advanced ticket sales, and also they do have to answer several screening questions when they arrive, as they get not their ticket right now, but their wristband. They're issued a wristband with a color coordination that will denote the coach that they will be sitting in. And then we are lining people up to board the train separately, 6 foot distance, and they're actually lining up by car color. And then we're loading the train one car at a time and trying to reduce people having to walk past others while on the train. So quite a few things are going on, really. Of course, our employees also are screened each morning with their temperature taken and the screening questions and so forth. So there's a lot to it.
What's the turnout that you've had so far? And what are you hearing from your peers at other museums like yours, either in the Southeast or elsewhere in the country?
Well, we've not had too many discussions with other tourist railroads or recreational railroads, whatever you'd like to call it, around. We're trying to stay in touch with the local attractions. Of course, also in discussion with the Chattanooga Tourism Company and the things that they're doing locally. And we're also aligned with several other groups that we try to take some pointers from, including the Southern Highlands Attractions Group, of which TBRM is a member. But we've had good ridership. We've had some additional capacity that has gone unused. But on a daily basis, when we're open, we definitely have visitors. They're having a good time and hopefully learning a little bit about our regional railroad history.
And for more information, where can people go online and where can they call?
Sure. Well, yeah, that is the best way to find out our current schedule and order your tickets online at our website, which is tvrail.com. And our phone number is 894-8028, of course, 423 area code. And we're happy to try to answer any questions. Our office is currently open on a limited basis, but if you don't get an answer when you call, you're always welcome to leave a message.
All right. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.